We good? All right, Blake, we up on Go Live? All right, good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to continue what we were doing last Sunday, and that was looking at some things related to Codex Sinaiticus. So I did think of a title for this, and I've decided to call it A Tale of Two Constantines, Rethinking Codex Sinaiticus. So this would be part two. So again, we're kind of going a lot more informal than we normally do. I just have handwritten stuff to myself as far as things that I want to remember to talk about. But I kind of want to start just with a review of some things, okay? So last Sunday we started talking about some things that I've learned about Codex Sinaiticus since April 1st. So this has only been about 2.5 months that I've been involved in looking at this, okay? But the first thing I want to do is I just want to review some basic facts about Codex Sinaiticus. The first one is the definition of a codex. A codex is basically an early form of a book, okay? It's called Codex Sinaiticus because of where it was found. It's found at St. Catherine's Monastery at Mount Sinai. Okay? And this would be like the... there's a monastery there. It's called St. Catherine's Monastery. It's located at Mount Sinai. The reason it's called Codex Sinaiticus is because where it's found. Okay? Some other distinguishing features. It is a four-column codex. That means there are four columns of printed text. Okay? You can kind of see it up here in the picture, but you can see 1, 2, 3, and then it kind of goes off because of the way they have the graphics set up. But there would be a fourth column over here. Okay? It is an uncial codex. An uncial codex means that it is all capital letters. So that's different from what they call a minuscule codex, which means it's written in all lowercase letters. Okay? It has part of the Old Testament. Not a complete Old Testament, but it has parts of the Old Testament. There is a complete New Testament in it. And that we saw last time that included the Epistle of Barnabas. And that it also included the Shepherd of Hermas. Okay, we talked about that last time. We'll review that in a minute. We saw that this was quote-unquote discovered for the first time in 1844 by Tischendorf, and he finds the first part at St. Catherine's Monastery at Mount Sinai. Okay, so these are just some... So I'm going to say 1844, first known... what do I want to say? First known sighting, I don't know. First known finding, okay, we'll go with that. That makes sense. First known finding of it is in 1844. Now I want to just show you something about that last point. So I have right here James Farrar's book from 1907 called Literary Forgeries. And as I told you last time, he writes this and has an entire chapter in here about Constantine Simonides and Codex Sinaiticus. And he says the following. He says the very... The fact that no visitor to the monastery at Mount Sinai before 1844 had ever seen or heard of such a work as belonging to the monks. Okay? So he's identifying the fact historically that no one before 1844 had ever reported seeing this codex at St. Catherine's Monastery at Mount Sinai. So this is the first known sighting of it. We talked last time at the beginning about how Mark 16, Matthew chapter 5, other passages are altered in the English Bible as a result and based on the authority of this singular codex. So this, the result of all of this is that it has been largely believed that this is the oldest Bible in history. Okay, and some people date the thing from the Council of Nicaea in 325. Okay, that it is that old, that it is a 4th century codex, and that the thing dates from 325. And therefore, this would make it one of the oldest Bibles in history. Okay? And of course, I also said to you at the beginning last time, and I want to make sure that I say this again, it doesn't matter to me whether the thing is an ancient fake or a modern fake. It doesn't matter to me. Because I've already rejected the Codex based upon a scriptural analysis. Right? When we studied preservation, we ended by talking about a multiplicity of copies, the fact that it is available, and the fact that it is in use. This thing, if this is true, that this is the first known existence of this thing, that means, was this thing ever copied?
No, probably not.
No. Was this thing ever in use?
No.
Was this thing available to the church throughout the history of the dispensation of grace?
No.
So from a scriptural analysis of the Codex, for me, I would reject it based upon that alone. So it doesn't matter to me whether it's an ancient fake or a modern fake. It doesn't matter to me along those lines. Okay? And I'll say it again. If, however, it is a modern creation from the 19th century, then it would be absolutely catastrophic to the critical theory. Because the critical theory is based upon this one and Codex Vaticanus, and we'll talk more about that probably maybe in a future lesson, okay? So that's just some factual things. I want to review also a few important facts from last week. Number one, in 2009, and it just clicked off again. In 2009, the British Museum in conjunction with the Royal Library of Russia and Leipzig University, they digitized Codex Sinaiticus in 2009 and they put it all online for somebody to look at. So I pointed this out to you last time, that those are the partner institutions that were involved in that process. In 2012, Chris Pinto did a video called Tares Among the Wheat, where he he basically brought forward some things about Farrar and a few other things that had been said about the Codex. So that started a conversation in 2012. In 2013, Pinto debated James White on a radio program. James White obviously has taken the exact opposite position. We'll get into that maybe more next time. Okay. There was also in 2013 a post-debate exchange between Pinto and White. In 2014, the University of Vienna hosted an entire weekend conference or symposium on this Constantine Simonides Fellow. Beginning in December 2015, running into 2016, David W. Daniels of Chick Publications began a 36-part vlog series titled Something Funny About Sinaiticus. Okay? In 2016, William Cooper wrote the Kindle book Forging Codex Sinaiticus, and then earlier this year, and again, this was my first introduction into this topic, Dr. David Sorensen published Neither Oldest Nor Best. Okay? So again, I say all that to tell you that this is not just some King James only crackpot theory here. Okay? This was something that was debated. Here are the journals. Again, this is only one journal. This is the Journal of Sacred Theology and Literature. This appeared in the Guardian newspaper, the Literary Churchman, and three or four other papers in the 1860s for over a three-year period debated the authenticity and the age of the Codex. I already mentioned J.A. Farrar. J.A. Farrar's 1907 book has an entire chapter in it regarding the age and antiquity of Codex Sinaiticus. So this is... This is not just some new thing that's just some crackpot King James only scheme here. This is an old debate that went away and has now resurfaced. And I do believe that one of the things that has led to the resurfacing of this debate is the fact that they have digitized the entire Codex and made it available online. Now, all that being said, I also said to you last time that all of these things, all these resources that have been made available, they're good, they're fairly good as far as their information is concerned, but they have one glaring weakness in my opinion, and that is they are far too conspiratorial. Okay? And so I told you that I was going to take a sort of a real factual approach to just laying some things out about this. Okay? So, what I want to do is I want to review some things from last week, draw the timeline back up here by way of review, and then what I want to do after that is talk. There were some questions. I got some questions this week about who this Simonides guy is. So I want to share with you a few things about him, and then I want to end with what we didn't finish last time about the Epistle of Barnabas. Okay? Is everybody good with that? Well, if you're not, that's what I got. So,
what are you asking for?
We're going to start with 1844. Okay? 1844, this is when Tischendorf discovers, quote-unquote, discovers at St. Catherine's Monastery the first 43 leaves of the Codex. Okay? So that's this date right here, the first known finding. I just read to you from Farrar. Farrar said that nobody before this time had ever reports having seen or uncovered this thing, right? So I told you last time that when Tischendorf finds the first 43 leaves, he takes them back with him to Germany. He gives them to the King of Saxony, who financed his trip. He gives them to him as a gift, and he publishes them in something that he calls CFA, Codex Frederico Augustanus, named after the King of Saxony. So this is what academic people do when there's some butt kissing and stuff like that that needs to go on, right? They name things after the people that financed the trip, right? So, that is the first known existence, but he only takes 43 leaves of the Codex at that point. We're not going to get into all the details right now about why. In 1853, Tischendorf goes to St. Catherine's Monastery again, and he finds nothing. Okay, now we'll talk about why that might be probably next week. Okay? 2 years after that, 1855, 56, a guy named Constantine Simonides shows up in Leipzig, Germany with a Greek copy of The Shepherd of Hermas. Okay? Now remember from last week, nobody before this had ever seen a Greek copy of The Shepherd of Hermas. They knew that it had originally been written in Greek, but the only thing that was known to have survived time in history was Latin copies of The Shepherd of Hermas. Okay? So this is received with great favor by two professors at Leipzig University in 1855, and they quickly moved to publish this Shepherd of Hermas in Greek, complete with a critical apparatus written by Simonides himself, and they do that in 1856. Okay? That same year, Tischendorf comes forward, the same guy that found this back here, so the other Constantine Tischendorf comes forward, and he says that that copy of Hermas is a fake and that it is a modern one. A modern work or a modern creation. Okay? And that was for a few reasons. And I'm going to have to just kind of do this. Number one, there are modern Greek words in it. Okay? So the Greek contained in it is not ancient Greek. Number two, there are issues with the grammar, which are too complicated for me to try to explain to you right now, okay? And number three, there are Latinisms. Okay? Those are examples of where the base text was a Latin text and they translated from Latin into what? Greek, right? And I told you that Tischendorf would have known all this stuff because his first claim to fame was a translation of Jerome's Latin Vulgate into what? Into Greek. So he would have known and been able to identify Latinisms. Okay? A few years after that, 1860, Simonides. Simonides ends up in... let me get ahead of myself. Hang on a second. Getting way ahead of myself, so I'm just going to get rid of that. I have here, in Latin... You can see Hermas right here. Okay? At the bottom of the page. You can see, I think you can see it, Tischendorf. Tischendorf's name on this. And it contains his analysis of the Simonides Greek Hermas And you can see him signing off here at the bottom of this in July 1856. Okay? So this is his review of Simonides' Greek what? Hermes, where he says it's a modern creation based upon these three basic points. Modern Greek, grammar, and what? Latinism. Is everybody with that? Okay? In 1859, good thing I checked my notes. In 1859, Tischendorf goes back to St. Catherine's Monastery. He recovers the remaining 315 leaves. He takes them to St. Petersburg because he's there under the auspices of the Tsar of Russia. And he publishes them as Codex what? Sinaiticus. Okay? Everybody with that? Hopefully you are, because if you're not, I don't know what I'm going to do. Okay, so. Now, contained in this, as I already said, is a Greek what?
Hermes.
A Greek Hermes and a Greek what?
Barnabas.
Barnabas. All right? Now, the problem is, the Greek of Hermes matches this Greek here that he's already said is what?
Fake.
A fake. Right? So I talked to you about him backtracking. This is from 1860. This is by Constantine Tischendorf. Everybody sees his name right there. This is from 1860, the year after he what?
Finds it.
The year after he finds it right now. Has he already said that this Greek Hermes produced by Simonides in 1856 is a fake, a modern fake?
Yeah.
Right? But what does he find when he examines Codex Sinaiticus? He finds in it a Greek copy of Hermes that matches the Greek of that he's already pronounced to be a what?
Fake.
Fake, right? So he has to backtrack, right? This is from 1856. This is in Latin. But with the help of Google Translate, I've been able to reproduce at the bottom what he's saying here, okay? And I'm going to read it to you in English. He says, quote, "I am glad to communicate that the Leipzig text," that's this one, the one he's already said is what?
Fake.
A fake, okay? "I'm glad to communicate that the Leipzig text is derived not from the Middle Ages, not from Middle Ages studies, but from the old original text." Okay? Now, why does he have to do that? Because he finds, bound hard to this, he finds almost the identical Greek in this that he's already declared to be a what? A fake. So here he is in 1860. So I'm going to write 1860 up here. 1860, now Tischendorf is what? He recants what he already said about the Greek previously in 1856. So this one's from 1856. This one's from 1860. And he's being forced to backtrack what he already said here, because he knows that if this is allowed to stand, it means that has to be a modern creation too. Is everybody with that? So he goes on to say, so I'm going to read the whole thing again. "I am glad to communicate that the Leipzig text is derived not from Middle Ages, not from Middle Ages studies, but from the old original text. My opposite opinion is proved to be correct insofar that the Leipzig is disfigured by many corruptions," blah, blah, blah. So all he says is, well, this is just my opposite what? Opinion, and then he moves on as though there were never any greater significance to all of this. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, 1863, Tischendorf does the same thing in Nuovo Testamentum Sinaiticum, which is Latin for the New Testament of what? Sinaiticus. Okay, that's in 1863. He does that. Okay, so also in 1863, Simonides ends up in Liverpool, England. This is in
1862. You said 1863.
I did? I was talking about the... So Simonides, also in 1860, he ends up in Liverpool, England. Okay? And the reason he's in Liverpool is to review a collection of manuscripts by a guy named Joseph Mayer, who has retrieved and purchased a set of manuscripts from ancient Egypt, talking about, a lot of it has to do with Egyptian history and that kind of thing. And he hires Simonides to kind of go through these. So this is how he gets to England in 1860, okay? That same year, Plymouth Brethren theologian and former associate, interestingly enough, of John Nelson Darby. Dispensational connection to the history here. B.W. Newton shows him a facsimile copy of Tischendorf's Codex Sinaiticus while he is in Liverpool in 1860. Is everybody with that? Okay. He immediately says that that's not an old codex. I what?
Wrote it.
I wrote it. Okay. In 1861, the British newspaper, July 27, 1861, the British newspaper runs the following story, quote, "We understand that in literary circles a rumor prevails that the manuscript now publishing by the Russian government under the direction of Mr. Tischendorf, purporting to be a manuscript of the Bible from the 4th century, is not an ancient manuscript, but is in its entirety a modern production written by a gentleman now alive, who will shortly take measures to establish his claim as to the authorship. The manuscript is known as Codex Sinaiticus and has attracted a large amount of attention throughout Europe. Should the rumor be proved correct, as we believe it will, the disclosures that will follow must be of the greatest interest to archaeology." That's July 27, 1861. So Simonides shows up in Liverpool in 1860, is shown a facsimile copy by B.W. Newton, and immediately says, "That's not old, I what?" This percolates around until the middle of 1861 when a paper picks up on it and runs the story that there's a rumor going around that somebody is claiming to be the modern author of what? Codex Sinaiticus, what Tischendorf discovered in 1859 and is now in the process of getting published under the auspices of the Russian government. Is everybody with that? The following year, 1862, and I do need to correct one date from last week. This is September 1862. Simonides writes the Guardian newspaper to share his side of the story. Okay? Is everybody with that? So I have had, should have, somewhere. Hang on. I don't know what I did with it. Maybe it's right here. I don't have it. Oh, here it is. So here's, this is the Journal of Sacred Literature. This is from October 1862. So the journal picks up on the article that was run by the Guardian the month before. Okay? This is long. Okay, this goes page after page after page of Simonides giving his account of the Codex. Okay, so rather than read all this, let me just summarize a couple key points for you about this. Okay, number one, he claims that he does it that it 1839 through 1840. Number two, he claims that it was a three-person job. That it was his uncle Benedict, who was the leader of the monastery at Mount Athos, Greece. Him, Simonides, and another guy named Dionysus, who was the calligrapher at the monastery, and they claim that the goal was to create a gift for the Tsar of Russia, in the hopes that the Tsar would give the monastery a printing press. So let me just read a few lines. He says, "About the end of the year 1830, the venerable Benedict, my uncle, spiritual head of the monastery and holy martyr at Pantaleon in Mount Athos, wished to present to Emperor Nicholas I of Russia some gift from the sacred mountain, in grateful acknowledgement of the presents which he had from time to time been offered to the monastery of the martyr. Not possessing anything which he deemed acceptable, he consulted with the head, Procopius, and Russian monk Paul, and they decided upon a copy of the Old and New Testaments written according to the ancient form in capital letters and on parchment. This, together with the remains of seven apostolic fathers, Barnabas, Hermas, Clement, Bishop of Rome, Ignatius, Polycarp, Papias, Dionysius, the Areopagite, they proposed should be bound in gold and presented to the emperor by a common friend. Dionysius, the professional calligrapher at the monastery, was then begged to undertake the work, but he declined, saying that the task was exceedingly difficult and he would rather not do so. In consequence of this, I myself determined to begin the work, especially as my beloved uncle seemed earnestly to wish it. Having then examined the principal copies of the Holy Scriptures preserved at Mount Athos, I began to practice the principles of calligraphy and the learned benefic, taking a copy of the Moscow edition of both testaments, published and pressed by Greek to illustrate, blah, 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 collated from ancient ones. And he's basically saying that he created it and that the intended reason why they created it was to give to the Tsar of Russia as a gift with the hopes of receiving what? A printing press in return. So he is claiming that there is a stash of manuscripts at Mount Athos that are ancient, that are important, that are significant, and they want to get them out by getting a printing press. And so this is what he is claiming the story was. Okay? Now, I'm sure a lot of you have questions about that, and rightfully so. Let me just share a couple more things about Simonides. So this is a quote from the Homilist paper, journal. And this is what they say about Simonides. They say, Dr. Simonides is Greek by birth, and he speaks and writes the classical language of his forefathers with fluency, purity, and elegance. He was born in the island of Hydrangea in the year 1824, being descended, and I think that date is a misprint, being descended on his father's side from many bishops and archbishops of the Greek church. In early life, he studied under the learned Benedict, the uncle of his mother, so it was actually his great uncle, in the monastery at Rhodes on Mount Athos. From this uncle, Simonides thoroughly acquired the art of paleography and became so great a proficient therein that few surpass him, either in the practice of it or in the diagnosis of manuscripts. He has moreover traveled much in Egypt and the East and has made important antiquarian discoveries. So they're saying that he's basically unmatched as far as his ability to analyze what? Manuscripts. I told you last time that this guy's almost like an Indiana Jones figure. This is from the Bath Chronicle, a newspaper from Thursday, March 13th, 1862, and it says just in part, in Macedonia, talking about Simonides, in Macedonia, his native country, he was only at the time on a visit. He succeeded in getting upon a very pretty little insurrection among his countrymen, and in conjunction with a few choice spirits who joined him in the leadership of the patriot bands, one fine morning fell on a detachment of Turkish soldiers, drove them into the river, and destroyed some 150 of them before breakfast. In this interesting transaction, he received a spent ball on his chest, so he was actually shot, and he had the musket wound to prove it. Okay? So this guy is a Greek patriot. He's fighting the Ottoman Turks. He's an expert in calligraphy and paleography, and he's doing all of these things, right? He's literally, like I said to you last week, sort of like an Indiana Jones-ish type figure. Okay? Now, I'm running out of room here, but in 1864, an English scholar named Donaldson. There you go, Blake. English scholar named Donaldson publishes a book called A Critical History of Christian Literature and Doctrine, and in it he talks about Hermas. Okay, and he makes the connection that the Greek of Hermas here in Codex Sinaiticus is virtually identical to the Greek where? in the one that Simonides published in 1856, right? Now we know over here, Simonides claims to have written what? Codex Sinaiticus, okay? So Donaldson says, the second class includes but one codex, Codex Palaeontis, 1500 in the Vatican Library. It belongs to the 14th century. You know what that tells you right there? That tells you that if he's right at all, that even if you don't believe Simonides did it in 1840, that what he copied was something that dated from the 14th century. So that would mean that the oldest this thing could be, that the oldest it could possibly be, is a 14th century manuscript. Because it's copying something in its Greek Hermes that existed, that is known to have existed then. You following that? So he goes on and talks about all of this stuff, right? I went over that last Sunday. I'm not going to do it again. In 1874, Donaldson produces an updated copy that contains further information and not so favorable information about Tischendorf. Okay? Talking about that his story about how he finds all of this and stuff like that is very unbelievable and fanciful and all this sort of thing. And he makes the same points again in 1874. Okay? Now, the point is that by 1871, the revision committee is already meeting to revise the King James Bible, and what ultimately happens, as you know, is they replace it with an entirely new text and so forth. This is from the Saturday Review from 1875, where they rip on Donaldson because of what he put forth the year before in 1874, noting the connection between the Greek Hermes and Codex Sinaiticus with the Greek of Hermes that was put where? That was already published, excuse me, in 1856. Now remember, has Tischendorf already flip-flop on this? Okay? And so what Donaldson's doing is he's pointing out is that there's a connection here, and he says that the arguments that are made for the recentness of the codex, the Greek of Hermes and Codex Sinaiticus, are tenfold stronger when you compare them to what was in Hermes. Okay? And so that was the Saturday Review. They rip on him. And they go on, starting at this line. Again, I don't have time to read all this to you, but starting here at this line, all the way down on that page, the whole rest of the page, all the way on to the back page to the top of the column here, saying what a creep and an idiot Donaldson is. Okay? Just want to share you something about Donaldson. This is Donaldson was elected as a fellow to the Royal Society of Edinburgh in 1867. And he became, in 1881, a professor of humanity at the University of Aberdeen. And in 1890, he was the principal of the university at St. Andrews. And he was knighted by Edward VII in 1907. So this guy's a real idiot, okay? By the University of Glasgow, and an honorary doctor of divinity by the University of Aberdeen in recognition of his work in church history. Well, what are the two books I just showed you about? Okay? His principal works include A Modern Greek Grammar for the Use of Classical Students, the Anti-Nicene Christian Library, the Critical History of the Christian Literature and Doctrine from the Death of the Apostles to the Nicene Council, Lectures on the History of Education in Prussia and England, Expository and Substitutionary Sacrifices of the Greeks, the Westminster Confession of Faith, blah, blah. I mean, you want me to go on, right? But this guy is a complete what? He's a complete idiot, apparently. Okay, so now let's move on to Barnum. All right, any questions about any of that? Tom, have I answered your question at all? Dave, do you have a question? Now, all that is basically a more detailed review of what we did last time, right? So, let's talk about something else. Still using Donaldson. So let me show it to you again. Donaldson writes this in 1874, talking about the connection between the Greek and Hermes and all this sort of stuff, right? Now I got to log into the whole thing. Okay. It'll come up. So he writes that in 1874. 1876, the Athenaeum Journal. Okay? The Athenaeum Journal of Literature, Science, and the Arts, January to June, 1876. They are reviewing a copy of the Apostolic Fathers. Okay? You will notice that the title of Donaldson's book is the what? The Apostolic Fathers. They are reviewing in this article a copy of the Apostolic Fathers, though, that had not been written by Donaldson. They are reviewing a different man's edition. But that does not stop them at the bottom of page 53 from going after Donaldson. Okay? So listen to what they say. They say, the editors are puzzled by an assertion in Donaldson's Apostolic Fathers. And again, they're not even reviewing Donaldson, but they're putting this in here for a reason. Okay? The editors are puzzled by an assertion in Donaldson's Apostolic Fathers on which we are able to throw some light. Dr. Donaldson mentions an edition of the Epistle of Barnabas printed by Simonides and containing the text as found in the Sinaitic Codex bearing a date of 1843. Donaldson saying that in 1843, Simonides produced a Greek copy of what? Barnabas. Well, I spelled it wrong.
No, 34. You got 34, not 43.
No wonder. I told you, I can't talk and write at the same time. Okay? So, Simonides is going to produce a Greek Barnabas. In 1843. Now just think about that. What are two of the distinguishing features of Codex Sinaiticus?
First known in 1843.
Barnabas and what? Hermas. I told you last week that Simonides already published a Greek copy of the Shepherd of Hermas that matched almost identical what was in Codex Sinaiticus. Okay? Lo and behold, what has he also published?
Barnabas.
Now think about that. The guy who's claiming to have written Codex Sinaiticus has already published, before Tischendorf finds anything in 1859, he has already published in Greek two of the distinguishing features of that codex before anybody has ever even seen that one. Codex. And the Greek that he publishes for Barnabas, guess what? It matches the Greek Barnabas that's where? Okay? Now you think about that. How is that possible? So let me go back. Is everybody with me so far? I got 20 minutes to do this, so. Yeah, good luck. But bearing the date 1843, so that's this right here, okay? And the place of publication, Smyrna. The editors put out a query. So that's the editors of the Athenaeum. They put out a query as to the date, 1843. The date given notwithstanding is an apparent improbability, is given correctly, and the addition of Barnabas is one of the most curious and many fabrications which Simonides devised. So what is the Athenaeum saying? They're saying that Simonides what? Made it up. Okay? The Greek, Simonides, went to the trouble of printing at his own expense an edition of the Epistle of Barnabas for the very purpose of putting the date 1843 upon it. You understand what they're saying? They're saying that Simonides went out and did what? I'm just going to mess with this so it doesn't go back to sleep. That Simonides, at his own expense, printed Barnabas and backdated it to what? 1843. Is everybody with that? He wished to make people believe that he had had manuscripts of the entire Barnabas before Tischendorf found his famous codex. So Simonides is a liar and a forger. The title page of this strange document states that the text of Barnabas is based on seven manuscripts. In this copy in which Simonides gave to the writer, it talks about having made some corrections in the preface. So they first accuse him of doing what? Well, first they're mad at Donaldson for even bringing it up. Okay? Then they accuse Simonides of printing Barnabas in Greek and backdating it to 1843, right? Then they say, Simonides was not content with printing the text. He produced an attestation of its genuineness and date of an edition of a newspaper of Smyrna, published in 1843, containing a long review of his work. Okay? So now what they're saying is he wasn't content to just backdate a copy to prove he was being legitimate. He actually produced a copy of a newspaper article from a newspaper in Smyrna, Turkey, containing a review of it dated what? 1843. So he didn't just print it and backdate it. He produced a fake newspaper article to prove that he what? Okay, you with that? The paper and the print of the newspaper looked uncommonly fresh, and on subsequent inquiries at Smyrna, it was found that no such newspaper had ever existed. So now they're saying he invented the whole newspaper. Okay? No such newspaper ever existed, and that the printer whose name appeared at the bottom was also entirely unknown. Simonides had taken the trouble to fabricate his newspaper as well as the date of his what? Now is everybody with that? What are they accusing him of? Number one, printing it and backdating it, right? Number two, saying that the newspaper never existed. And number three, forging an entire copy of it to prove it, okay? So, book, Report on Smyrna, 1856, page 40. Of the educational development of the little class, of the middle class, any population, the character of their favorite journals may be taken as tolerably good indication are Greek and one French. Three Greek, excuse me, and one French. Of the three Greek, one, the Amphela, is a journal of considerable pretensions, and the other two, the Star of the East. Did you notice that they never told you in here the name of the newspaper? Why do you think they didn't tell you that? Because could you, if they told you the name of the newspaper, could you have figured out and gone and checked for yourself? So are they totally expecting you to take their word for it and that Donaldson's an idiot? And that Simonides is this gross, massive liar and forger, right? 1856, does this prove that that paper existed? Okay? 1836. Travels in Greece and Turkey. 1836. Smyrna seems the headquarters of the missionaries who have established here a religious newspaper called the Star of the East. 1836. Is everybody with that? Now let me show you why. Oh, I also have here the Ante-Nicene Fathers. This is from 1907. They list the date of the Epistle of Barnabas at the red mark there. They note one by Simonides published in 1843. Is everybody with that? So why is this important? So we're going to go to see the manuscript. We're going to go to Barnabas. Now, it's big enough that you can see it. This is the end of the book of Revelation. This is the beginning of the Epistle of Barnabas. You will notice that it is the Epistle of Barnabas is bound hard to the end of the book of Revelation. So, do these have the same origin and provenance then?
Yeah.
Remember we talked about that last week, right? Okay. So, whatever you want to say about the New Testament in Sinaiticus, you also have to say about the epistle of Barnabas and Sinaiticus, because it is bound hard to the end of the book of Revelation, and they share the same one. They share the same page. Okay? So the Athenian has said that he never... that he backdated it and so forth and lied about it, that the newspaper, they don't give you the name of the newspaper, they call Donaldson an idiot, and they do all this stuff, right? Is everybody with that? Okay? So, I wrote to the University of Aristotle in Thessaloniki, Greece 2 weeks ago, and I received a PDF copy of the 1843 publication of the Epistle of Barnabas by Simonides in 1843. I didn't print the whole thing, but if you want to see it, you'll be able to see it right down here, that there's a publication date on this thing of 1843. Okay? Now, what did the Athenian Journal say about that? They said that he printed it and that he backdated it, right? Then, to prove that he wasn't lying, what did Simonides produce?
A newspaper.
He produced a newspaper from the Star of the East. A newspaper that they said was what?
Not real.
There's a title page of the Star of the East from 1842, proving that the paper did what?
Exist.
Is everybody with that? Then they said not only did he make up the newspaper, but that he also forged what? That he forged the editorial reviewing his epistle of Barnabas from what? 1843. Okay? And that he lied and that he never did it. Wrote to a university in Athens. There's the article right there. Bottom of the corner is the beginning of the review of Simonides, the Shepherd of Hermas, from the Star of the East, dated from 1843. Okay? Now, is everybody with all that? So, Simonides' story checking out according to the relevant facts. Now, let me go to a different page in Barnabas. I think it's 20. Yep. Whoops. So, does everybody see? I got three examples here. So this is the main text of Barnabas. You see these marginal corrections? You see those on the picture there? Everybody sees them, right? So why do we have to make all this stuff up about Simonides? Because if you take this base text of the Epistle of Barnabas and add the handwritten marginal corrections, guess what they equal? They equal the standalone 1843 publication of the Epistle of Barnabas in Greek by Simonides in 1843 before Tischendorf found anything. You with that? Then that means that the two of the biggest distinguishing features of Codex Sinaiticus are completely explainable by standalone copies of Barnabas and Hermas written by the very guy and published by the very guy who claimed he wrote it in 1840. You with that? Now that's a lot to swallow, I know. Because I've been trying to swallow it now for 2.5 months. Okay? But the facts suggest... Now, so why do we have to invent all this story about what he did in 1843 is not being real? Because somebody knows that Donaldson is on the verge of letting an extremely big cat out of a very big bag that nobody wants anybody to know about. Okay? Because when Donaldson writes his second one in 1874, and the Athenaeum responds in 1876, are we way into the process now in that revision? And are they completely revising the Bible based upon that codex that they think is a 4th century codex from the year 325? And now this guy comes forward and in demonstrable fashion can say, I wrote it, it's not old. And two of the very distinguishing features of it that nobody had ever seen before, an entire copy of the Epistle of Barnabas in Greek, along with Greek of Hermas, he has already published and produced in standalone editions before the majority of the thing is found by Tischendorf in 1859. Now, that is either the most fanciful coincidence ever in world history, or Simonides is telling the truth. I mean, you could still take the position, I suppose, that he's lying, but if you're going to, you're going to have to explain these extremely improbable oddities if he's not telling what? The truth. Let me back up. In February of 1843, a friend of Simonides, a monk named Kalanikos, says that he saw Simonides at Mount Athos with a copy of Codex Sinaiticus going over it. 2 months later, in April 1843, he publishes in Greek the Epistle of Barnabas. What do you think he was doing in February 1843? He was taking this, along with the corrections, and collating them into a standalone one. Now you say, why would he only do Barnabas and Hermas? Well, think about it. If the whole thing is intended to be a gift for the Tsar of Russia in the first place, then the only two parts of this thing that would even be legitimate or of interest to anybody in his mind would be the two unique parts, which would be a Greek Barnabas that nobody's ever seen before and a Greek Hermas that nobody's ever what? Seen before. And oh, by the way, if he's doing this in 1843 and he's doing this in 1856, then are there, as he claimed in his writing, are there unique manuscripts at Mount Athos, Greece, that nobody had ever seen before? And his text proves it. Okay? So, I got to go back. I did all that. I need to look at the Barnabas notes. Let me make sure I got everything. Yeah, that was pretty much it. So we have time for a few questions. Now, listen, I'm looking at this and I'm seeing like, this is like, you got to think about this stuff because this is a lot of historical moving around and who's doing what, where, when, and why. Okay? Does anybody have any questions or comments? Fred?
Most of these individuals that you're talking about here, all through these years, with the exception of Donaldson, are they basically Roman Catholics or associated with the Catholic Church or with the Greek Orthodox?
Tischendorf is officially a Lutheran. Okay, he's from Germany. He's a Lutheran. Simonides is just a Greek Orthodox, basically a Greek Orthodox dude who was raised in that family, so he's not really. I would consider him to be a Greek Orthodox kind of a believer, and the rest of them in England are all various. You know, the fact that there's a dispensational touch point in all this with B.W. Newton just blew me away. B.W. Newton is friends with Tregellis, who attacked Simonides. And B.W. Newton was a former associate of John Nelson Darby before they split camp over dispensational agreements. So the whole thing is just it's just an amazing story, as it were. And I don't think we've even... what I've started with here, to me, are the two biggest smoking guns in this whole discussion. Okay? So if we were lining up dominoes, and the question was whether or not we believe Simonides, okay, and whether or not he's telling the truth, the Hermas and Barnabas, to me, once those two dominoes fall, then all the rest of the dominoes fall in favor of Simonides. The rest of the bits of the story. Does that make sense? Because you can attach him to independently producing the two of the most distinguishing features of this codex before Tischendorf has seen any of it. Okay? And when he finds... think about Tischendorf. When he finds that thing in 1859, the remaining portion of it, he has to just... and he realizes that Hermas is in that thing, and he realizes that, uh-oh, I've already said this, I've got to now what? I got to retract, I got to backtrack, or else what I said about this will apply to this, and then there goes my whole apple cart. All of that is extremely telling about what's going on here. Okay? Not to mention the fact that all of this is happening. Remember how many times in the class have I stressed that time period from 1860 to 1900? Okay? And then they try to, you know, skewer Donaldson in the press, and they make up this story, and you can prove that the paper did exist. There's existing copies of it. There's the one from the library in Greece, and there's the 1843 Barnabas. Now, if all you had was the 1843 Barnabas, I guess you could say, well, maybe he did publish it and backdate it. But when you have the review of it published in 1843, now you're like, oh, well, then he must be telling what? The truth. Okay? Yeah.
If you compare that skewering, as you call it, with modern day tactics, humankind's methods have changed a lot.
No, they haven't changed a lot. And the two biggest objections to him telling the truth are, number one, his age. That Simonides would have been about 20 years old when he did this. And number two is, well, where did he get the readings from? Well, okay, if you get over the question of age, the second, and seemingly more confrontational question would be, well, where did he get the readings from? Well, if he had these readings when he created it, then he obviously had access to readings at Mount Athos that nobody else had. So that goes out the window, and now the only thing you're left with is, well, could a 20-year-old have done this? I don't know. I mean, I see the art that 16, 17, 18-year-olds produce at my school, and I can't do it. So if that's all you have now, because you're evaluating this not based on some conspiracy theory, but based upon the facts and what Simonides has access to and when he has access to it, and I should probably write up here that he's claiming that he produced the codex in what year? 1840. All right? Anything else? Now, I got more on this if you want it to go another week.
Oh, good. So people really have a problem with a Greek 20-year-old being able to write a Greek text?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of them is James White.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a problem with it. Now, I think Chris Pinto, when he debates James White, he makes some pretty basic mistakes. Okay? And James White gets them all bogged down into this big discussion about whether Chris Pinto has ever collated any Greek manuscripts, which Pinto has to obviously answer no. But the question isn't whether or not Pinto or anybody else has ever collated Greek manuscripts. It's, has James White seen every Greek manuscript on Mount Athos? And if his answer is obviously what? No, then he cannot say beyond the possibility of doubt that there's not things at Mount Athos that he's never seen before.
Or weren't.
Maybe there aren't now, but or weren't. You with that? Because I can show you pretty much, it seems to me, beyond reasonable historical doubt that he had access to readings, at least in terms of Barnabas and Hermas, that nobody had ever seen before he published them. We got